Okay, our next speaker is Derek Pawelczyk. He's a veteran of the web in one of the true and the good senses. He's been around for a long time. I first was aware of Derek through his website Fray a number of years ago. And it just the idea that you could tell stories on the web, tell personal stories on the web and share them with others was one of the things that really attracted me to the web and got me involved and just seemed so exciting at the time that you could do that. He's worked at the intersection of film and of print and of stories and dealt a lot with community. So he's really a person that's got a lot of interest to say today and what we need, and he's going to be talking to us about the wisdom of communities. So please welcome Derek to the stage.
Good morning. Thank you very much for coming and for your attention and for that wonderful intro. And I wanted to also make sure to thank all of the Webstock folks. They invited my wife Heather and I to the last two Webstocks, and we were unable to make it, and it's only because of their sheer perseverance that the third time's the charm, so here we are. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you guys. So, today I would like to talk to you a little bit about the wisdom of communities, and I am outright aping the title of James Surowiecki's book, The Wisdom of Crowds. Who has read that book? Fantastic. Some of this will be a little primer, a little refresher for you about that book. And I'm going to take some of his ideas that are really about economics and apply them to web communities and see what happens. The wisdom of crowds is a hideously misunderstood concept. The idea that you can take a bunch of people and put them in the same place and all of a sudden they're smarter is generally not true. In fact, having a wise output from your community is the exception to the rule, not the rule itself, as anybody who has seen YouTube comments can attest. I'm mad at Jane for stealing that screenshot earlier in the day. So let's talk about what is the wisdom of crowds, what does it really mean? And it all starts with these two characters. In 1906, Francis Galton, who's the guy on the right, thank you, visited a livestock fair and stumbled on a contest. An ox, that's the one on the left, was on display, and the villagers were invited to guess the animal's weight after it had been slaughtered and dressed. And nearly 800 gave it a go. Now, Galton's theory was that the elite were good at these kind of guessing games, and the rabble, that would be us, were really bad at it. And so after the contest, where everybody guessed the weight, and no one got it right, he took all the guesses, and it was kind of an elitist, ha-ha, look how dumb they are. But he figured something very strange out, which is that if you took the median of all the guesses, the median came out to 1,200 pounds. The exact mark was 1,198 pounds. This is what we mean when we say the wisdom of crowds. And there are lots of examples of this in real life. The stock market is a constantly evolving example of this, where lots of people are making individual choices based on their own self-interest, but the aggregate data actually determines the health of companies. There are some other non-traditional examples. If you've ever, searched for an MP3 on a file sharing network? No, don't raise your hand. How fast that file comes into you is a measure of how many other people have that file, which is like a wisdom of crowds community. In other words, the more popular a file, the faster it'll be because more people have it. So let's quickly talk about what Surowiecki's four elements of the wisdom of crowds are, and then we can kind of pervert it to be our web community elements. His four are diversity, which doesn't mean just diversity of participants, but diversity of opinions. Independence, which means everybody can make up their own mind. Decentralization, which means it's a bottoms-up process where there's no grand boss in charge of telling you what to do. An aggregation, some mechanism that takes all of that input and produces the wise result. It's not really wisdom of crowds system without all four of these pieces. So how does this work if you take it and put it online? This is how what I've kind of boiled it down to. Give people small, simple tasks. Give those tasks to a large, diverse group of people. Design the process for selfishness, and then aggregate the results. So let's take each one of those in kind. Interface will make or break a wisdom of crowds system. Simplicity has to be the rule. Wisdom of crowd techniques are really good for something like guessing the bull's weight. They have to have a collective outcome. It's wonderful to post your comments online and feel good for having done so, but that's not contributing necessarily to wisdom of crowds outcome because it's just talking, and that's great, but that's not exactly what we're trying to get at today. If you need to bring in complicated input, then hold an open call for submissions. Have a discussion board, and that's fine. But wisdom of crowd tasks work really well when there's a point to them. Like this. You guys know Hot or Not. It goes back a long time. This is a wisdom of crowds technique applied to something that probably doesn't need wisdom. But it is exactly what it seems. If you don't know, people upload photos, and then people judge if they're hot or not. Unless you worry it's a sexist thing, you can also select males from the drop-down too, and both sides get it. There's an open question as to whether this produces a wise result. What it definitely does, though, is it does produce a result that is a collection of simple tasks aggregated to produce a number. Let's look at an example that does something a little more fun and reasonable. Here is Threadless's voting page. Who knows Threadless? Fantastic. The quick one-sentence definition is a crowdsourced t-shirt store where the community uploads designs, the rest of the community votes on which designs should be printed as t-shirts, and then the company ultimately uses that wisdom to pick which shirts get printed. So this is their voting algorithm, or voting interface. You'll notice it looks a lot very similar to Hot or Not, except now we're deciding which t-shirts we want to print. Personally, I think both of these are overcomplicated, and I tend towards simple yes or no, thumbs up, thumbs down systems, but that's going a little deeper. Here's an example of one that didn't quite work so well. Assignment Zero was a collaboration between Wired Magazine and a group called News Assignment. Headed by Jeff Howe, who's the guy who coined the term crowdsourcing. So he should kind of know what he's doing. And he does. But in this case, they learned something very interesting. What they did is said, we are going to make magazine quality content with the crowd. So we're going to have this kind of wiki Drupal backend, and we're going to put out these, people can say what stories they think they should write, and other people can write them, and it'll be a big happy melting pot of crowdsourced material about crowdsourcing. How do you sign crowdsourcing? Crowdsourcing. Thank you. Just curious. But what happened was a big crowd came together and they went, yes, we love crowdsourcing and we are interested in this. And then the organizer said, okay, great, go do stuff. And they went, I don't know how to write a news story. They were asking for too much. They had violated that first rule of small, simple tasks. So there was this collective freakout on the part of the organizers of the site, and they recovered brilliantly. So what they did is they went out and said, okay, scratch that. Who do you think we should interview about this topic? And the crowd said, oh, well, here's a bunch of people. And they made a brilliant list of hundreds of people that have something to say about this. Then they said, okay, who wants to interview each one? And people went, oh, an interview? I know what that is. I can just ask them some questions and they can answer, and then I can document that and put it up. Every single interview, done. And then they went through a refining process. This small, simple task exchange mirrors what Wikipedia fell on naturally, where they would say anybody could write a page, but the truth is very, very few people actually started the page. That took a kind of creator element. But once the page was started, many, many people did small edits. And those small, simple tasks combined are what create the value later. The second part, large, diverse groups, has nothing to do with that dog. I just kind of like dogs. SirWiki talks about the NASA Challenger shuttle disaster as an example of what happens when groups become too homogenous, too close to outside ideas. There were low-level people at NASA who were raising red flags about the O-ring's potential for failing in cold weather, which is exactly what happened, which caused the Challenger to be destroyed. But the decision makers were so cut off from those, that diversity of opinion, that they became ensconced in what is called groupthink. Groupthink is when each individual person in the crowd kind of gives over their independence of thinking to the group. So instead of thinking selfishly, what do I want to have happen? They say, well, what's good for the group is good for me. And that's actually very, very bad for Wisdom of Crowd communities, because it's the selfishness of our desire, our, and the kind of self-centeredness of our opinions that make the input diverse. So groups get stupid when they stop thinking. And the shuttle disaster is a very good example of that, but I kind of like this one online. This is the Chevy Tahoe campaign a few years ago, where Chevy Tahoe said, I know, we'll crowdsource our next advertisement. So they put up a tool where people could select photos of their brilliant giant SUV gas-sucking monster. And the only place the community could really use its voice is in what text they added on top of these images. So they did this. And I would have loved to have been there in the meeting at the ad agency where they said, I know, we'll let people make ads for our giant gas-sucking SUV. And everyone in that room went, that's a fantastic idea. What could possibly go wrong? Well, this is what went wrong. So people did create content for them. I wouldn't say it was wise. It was definitely funny. So I think this is a failure of groupthink in a web context, of not knowing who your group is and not knowing how they'll respond. The third thing in my little list is design for selfishness, and that's my dog Bug, who's a sweetheart and not selfish. And I touched on it earlier, but I want to go a little deeper onto it. When we talk about communities, there's this kind of touchy-feely granola hippie thing that comes out of wanting to say it's all good and we're all in it, and all of that stuff feels really, really good. But the problem is it doesn't work, and it leads to groupthink, and groupthink leads to bad things. What we're talking about when we talk about Wisdom of Crowds communities is aggregating selfish behavior to make something good for the group later. And here's some examples of that. When we all make websites, we are not trying to make Google smarter. We are not working for the good of Google. But all of our individual linking decisions aggregated by Google in their algorithm, PageRank, creates a billion-dollar company. Right? That is the Wisdom of Crowds in action. Here's another one. Dear Flickr, when we all tag our photos, we're not doing it because we want to make Flickr smart. We're not thinking about the Flickr community. We're thinking about us. I want to be able to find my Webstock photos later, so I'm going to just tag them with Webstock. You might even be my friend and want to help me, so you'll add that tag for me. But collectively, all of our tagging behavior, aggregated properly, becomes so smart that Flickr, when you do a tag search for Apple, they can say, well, did you mean Apple the Macintosh, or Apple the fruit, or Apple New York City? Nobody grouped those except for an algorithm. So I think that's part of the reason why selfishness is good. Selfishness properly aggregated can lead to things that are good for the rest of the community. And selfishness also goes on under the auspices of prizes. Remember back to the original weighing the ox experiment, the reason they were all trying to weigh the ox is that they got the ox, if they were right. So that leads to the fourth bit, which is result aggregation. So we've got small, simple tasks given to a large, diverse group of people who are participating for their own motivations. Now you have to take all those results and add them up. And here's where things get slightly complicated, because results are often numbers. And when you show numbers, that's a leaderboard. And as soon as you have a leaderboard, that's a game. And games change people's output. The wonderful talk by Jane earlier today about games got me thinking about this. And I think it's important for all of us community designers, people making participatory sites online, to realize that though they may not have started out wanting to make a game, games are the result. And so the games aren't bad, and a lot of times people talk about gaming a community as a bad thing. Looking at your community as a game is a great idea, but you have to make sure that the way to win the game is to do something that benefits the community. If the way you win the game is to get attention by saying, first post, then you're not really contributing to the life of the community. So a case in point is, who knows Slashdot, one of the oldest tech community blogs there is. They created Karma Points. And in the beginning, Karma Points were just a simple way for the system to kind of remember the things you do and increment these points. Programmers think in points, and that's OK. Increment these points up or down depending on whether what you did was well-liked by other people. Because it's an open source project, people saw into the code and their members realized they were getting points. And you can't tell someone, you have points, but I'm not going to tell you how many points you have, because that's crazy making. So they made a compromise. They said, well, we're not going to show you everybody's points. We're just going to show you your points. But as soon as you assign points to a member, then they have a game, and that is when Karma Whore started. And Karma Whores were people who would post simply to get voted up for what they contributed. And if that's not groupthink, I don't know what is. So you would go into Slashdot and say, yeah, Microsoft is bad. And you know, half the people in the room would go, yeah, you're right. And then you would have great Karma Points. But that wasn't actually adding anything to this, to the discussion or adding anything to the community. So if we want to do this wisdom of crowds thing, and the result of the aggregation is a ranked list of points or participation, but you don't want to create a leaderboard or a game, how do you balance these two things? Well, here's one example. So this is Favored. This is making a game out of Twitter. And instead of asking members to explicitly vote on whether, yes, and this was taken last night, so it should be a current Twitter. Instead of asking people to explicitly vote, like hot or not, is this a good Twitter, all they're doing is monitoring the favoriting behavior of the existing members. So while some members may know that they're participating in this game, most don't. And they're simply clicking that little star next to their favorite Twitters because they like them. This enables Favored to show a leaderboard that doesn't directly influence the output of the game. So one way to aggregate results without skewing the game is to monitor behavior that is not necessarily explicit. And when you pull all those things together, you can create amazing things, t-shirts, all kinds of crowdsourced projects. I personally create Frey. This is the part where I plug Frey. Frey started out as a community website where people posted stories. It kind of mutated into a series of real-life storytelling events, and now has mutated again into a print magazine, which you just saw. So it's effectively evolving backwards. And almost everything I've learned about raising community online has come from this amazing project. The simple power of storytelling online creating a community of people that care about that, that took it out of online and into real life, I think has been amazing to watch. The thing I wanted to mention about this is that all successful virtual communities ultimately resolve to real life. So it's one of the symptoms of knowing you're doing it right. I mentioned the how to use Wisdom of Crowds techniques without influencing the outcome. This is what I call the Heisenberg problem, where you know the location of a particle or its acceleration, but not both at the same time. And here are a couple other interesting solutions to how to balance these issues. When Flickr launched Interestingness a while back, the first thing they did, and I love you, Flickr, but the first thing they did, because it was written by programmers, was, well, we have this Interestingness algorithm. It does what I was saying before, which is it monitors behavior around photos with not explicit things. So no one's saying, I vote for this to be an Interestingness, but it's monitoring who's commenting, who's how many favorites it has, et cetera, et cetera. There's an algorithm. But the output of the algorithm was this ranked list. And every day, it showed the winners of the 500 best photos. Now, this can be good in that if you're a new person coming to the site, you get to see a admittedly pretty good set of photos, but it's bad because it created a game. And so no matter where you wound up, if one of your photos wound up on this list, no matter where it wound up, there was somebody ahead of you. And that was crazy making. So now you're going to do the things, you're going to try to give yourself the extra edge. And people have been devoting themselves to figuring out the algorithm that leads you to here, whether it's, and it created bad behavior such as, well, maybe having my photo in lots of groups would help its Interestingness score, so I'm going to post it to a lot of groups, which is like group spamming, et cetera, et cetera. So they did a revision a little while after this was out. This is still there, but it's kind of sidelined. And now, when you go to the default last 7 days of Interestingness, they're doing something that I think is much better, which is they're taking the interesting photos and displaying a random grid of 9. So they're still using the algorithm, but they're kind of obfuscating the results. And it's actually really fun to come here and keep hitting refresh and seeing a new spectrum of photos. Now, Google couldn't get away with this because you really need one top result for them. But for something like photos, having a random assortment of algorithmically determined interesting photos, I think, is a great solution to the Heisenberg problem. Here's how Threadless deals with it. They allow voting on the t-shirts, but do not display any of the collected metadata until the voting has ended. So they separate the voting process and the reveal process. And so here you can see a t-shirt that has gotten 1.13 out of 5. It's hard. I've submitted t-shirts here. And here's another very great way to just separate the two pieces, which is just sequence. First, ask people to vote, and then show them the results after. This is every web poll you've ever seen. Thank you, IO9. The point I want to make sure that I make here is that if you do all these steps to having voting algorithms and essentially contests, the first thing you're likely to do is say, well, we want to find out what the most popular thing is. And that's okay. That's every most emailed stories or every New York review of top books. But I want to get you thinking about this, that just because you have scores on simple tasks and judging content, popularity does not have to be the result. Popularity is one very simple kind of algorithm. Show me the stuff that got the most good votes. But you could just as easily say, show me the stuff that got a lot of very high votes and a lot of very low votes as the controversial stuff. And this is what Reddit has a controversial sort. You could just as easily say, well, show me stuff that started out high but fell down real fast, or stuff that people liked who are like me, or stuff that people liked who are not like me. Show me the Threadless t-shirts that actually get bought by the people who voted for them. All that data is there, they're just different sorts on the actual data. So while it might be tempting to say, let's just show the good stuff, there's a lot more opportunities in here. And I also wanted to mention one other thing, which is that human editors still matter in this process. My wife and I started a photography magazine called JPEG, and the way that worked was there are gating levels of decision making. So we would put out a contest. The first gate was the photographer's self-interest. The photographer could only submit one photo to each theme. So immediately the photographers are a gating mechanism. So they're going to pick their one best photo. Then there was a community review process where people voted up or down on those submissions. So that's a peer review. And then finally, the last selection, because it is an art magazine, was made by the editors. So we were using wisdom of community tools to narrow the playing field, but the final selection was made by experts. This is the kind of thing that would make SirWiki cry, but in the case of an art magazine, a funny thing I learned about photographers is they all secretly want to be judged. So it was less impressive for them to be picked by the community as it was to be picked by experts. The point I'm trying to make is that it doesn't have to be an all or nothing system. There can be a blend of human intelligence and collective intelligence. In fact, I think one of the reasons these systems so often fail, like every time DIG changes its algorithm and all of their people freak out, is because they have said from the outset, we will not influence this. But I think it's appropriate to influence it, especially when you're making media. That's what media does. That's what editors are for. All right, so now we have a kind of recipe for wisdom of crowd techniques. The very next thing that most people say when I talk to them about this is, what about the trolls who are going to come screw it all up? A troll is somebody who posts controversial, inflammatory, off-topic. They derail the game. A troll is not someone who disagrees with you online, though they may be. A troll is usually the person who pokes the guy who just freaked out. A troll's not the guy freaking out. A troll's the one who talked to him right before that. This is a troll. His name is Jason Fortuny. This was a photo from the New York Times. Please don't tell him I'm talking about him. Seriously, he scares me. He's the guy who did the Craigslist experiment. In 2006, he posted a post to Craigslist saying he was a woman looking for sex, and all the men who wrote to him, sending photos and descriptions about why she should choose him to have sex with, he just took all that and posted it. He caused at least two people to lose their jobs. That is a good troll. In 2007, when Meghan Meyer committed suicide after being harassed on MySpace by someone who she thought was her friend but turned out to be the parent of her friend, Fortuny created a site called Meghan Had It Coming, which was supposedly written by a classmate of Meghan Meyer. The website was reported as true on CNN and Fox. Trolls thrive on gullibility. They thrive on our collective decision to take them seriously. In the New York Times article, which I linked from my site, so you guys should definitely read, this guy, Jason, tells a story has an exchange with the author of the story. And it's his theory of green hair, and I want to make sure to say it to you because it is the one way you can inoculate yourself against trolls. And this is him talking to the reporter. He says, you have green hair. And she says, no, I don't. And he says, why not? She says, I look in the mirror and I see that my hair's not green. She goes, and he says, oh, that's interesting. I guess you understand then that you're a terrible reporter. And she said, what do you mean? What did I do? And he said, that's a very strange reaction. Why didn't you get so defensive when I said you had green hair? If it was certain that you were a terrible reporter, you would have reacted the same way. So the point is, when someone's trying to get your goat, ask yourself, do I have green hair? Except for anyone who does, this is a really effective way to inoculate yourself against a troll. Basically, when you don't respond, they go away. It's the only way to make them go away. So if we run a community, how do we identify them, and then what do we do about it? You can identify a troll very easily. Somebody who is repeatedly disrupting the flow of things, someone pointing in the wrong direction, not trying to disagree, but simply breaking the game, whatever the game is. Someone who repeatedly steers conversation away from whatever the topic is into whatever their pet is. And then when all else fails, your friend the server log, which can tell you when people are creating puppet accounts so they can yell at each other and get people into the fight. When I started designing community sites, I had no idea that people would register multiple accounts and talk to themselves on your site. But they do, and the server logs can tell you that. Once you find that, what do you do about them? Well, the most, like I said before, trolls are playing a game where the currency is attention, and winning the game is destroying the site, the community, the project. So the only way to inoculate yourself to them is to not respond. So if you identify one in your community, you can't talk to them and say, hey, stop being a troll, because that just works better. So there's a thing that I like to call the silent treatment, which is in any logged-in community, you have a tool where you can simply say, that user can only that user can see the posts they make. You put the cone of silence over them. So that way the troll comes in and goes, hey, Macs are better than PCs. You know, let's talk about something controversial. Abortion is awesome, whatever. And crickets, nothing happens. And they might try a few more times, and if they get no reaction, they'll just move on to the next watering hole, because this community has been inoculated. They're not gullible anymore. That can be a really effective way to diminish their effect. Another is to simply keep an eye out for those puppet accounts that we talked about. There is almost, and it depends on your community, but almost no reason why any community would need puppet accounts, especially if they're fighting with each other. And timeouts. Most community designers create a set of tools for admins and create a set of tools for the normal people, and then create a set of boot tools that are the extreme of basically, you annoy us, we delete your account. And there's no middle ground of, you know, you're having a bad day, clearly, so why don't you just have a timeout? When you think about real-life communities you may have been a part of, if you walked into your group of friends and had a complete meltdown, someone would take you off to the side and say, dude. Well, I'm from California. We say, dude, are you having a bad day? And they talk you through it, and then you can go back to being part of your group. Most online tools are not built this way for no apparent reason other than it's just harder. But any tool that allows user contributions, you should be able to assign a timeout to. This is my last slide. It's my favorite slide, and I've rushed through the others because I really wanted to tell you about it. And this slide starts with a story and ends with a study. The story is about my grandmother. The reason I'm telling it to you is because we've been talking about trolls, and we want to say, well, why do people do this? Besides the fact that they do, why are they there? What is happening? Why are we so much more prone to freakouts online than we are sitting in this room? So here's the story about my grandmother. She once told me why she stopped making cucumber salad. She'd been chopping cucumbers when her hands started to hurt. She thought the cucumbers caused the hands hurting. It made total sense. It's also completely wrong. Her hands hurt because she had arthritis. But no amount of lecturing from my dad could change her mind. In Yiddish, this is called babamansis. It means mother stories. But we all do it. We form these connections. Our brains are wired to take a ton of input and turn it into narrative stories that help us understand the world. Imagine your brain as if it's sitting in a movie theater, watching the flashing screen behind your eyes. It takes all the separate images and creates a story around them, like you're just hearing these words I'm saying in real time, but it's really a group of random input that our brains have gotten used to making stories around. What's interesting is if you take away some of that input, our brains work twice as hard to fill in the gaps. Instead of saying, I don't quite know what's going on, they work twice as hard to create stories around whatever they're seeing. There's a podcast called Radiolab. Has anybody ever heard Radiolab? They did a thing about this. Definitely look it up, subscribe. It's brilliant. But they talk to fighter pilots who, in extreme gravity situations, when their brains start shutting down, have these lucid fantasies, these lucid waking dreams of doing things. And what they realized it was their neurons in their brain trying to connect whatever input they had, however limited, to create stories around it. This is relevant online because we have so much less input than our real-life social situations. Virtual communications like blogs and email comments and instant messages come without all the associated social data that our brains are used to. And in the absence of the context, our brains fill in the rest. And what we fill it in with is a byproduct of our own insecurities. So people who are prone to looking at the world in a positive light fill in those gaps with a web full of well-meaning, good people. And people who might be slightly damaged, who might be a little more nihilistic, fill in those gaps with slight and anger and want to go mess with you back because they're justified in it. Recently, and here's the study part, a researcher named Jennifer Whitston published a study in the Journal of Science called Lacking Control Increases Illusory Pattern Perception. I'm not going to try to say that again. She did an experiment with two large groups of people that were given a test. One was the in-control group, and one was the out-of-control group. She asked both groups a series of questions. The in-control group was told that their answers were always right, no matter what they were. The out-of-control group was told that their answers were half right, half wrong, but with no relation to the questions being asked. So the in-control group was put into a place of feeling good about themselves. And the out-of-control group were feeling out of control and bad. Then both groups were shown a series of images like this. Cloud patterns, static. They were shown images where nothing was really there. And here's the super interesting part. The out-of-control group was way more likely to see things in the static. Their brains were making connections because they felt out of control. The in-control group could look at the photos and go, well, that's clouds. That's just noise. That's just static. So how this is relevant to online communities is that it kind of puts some science behind what we've all observed of people feeling out of control and thinking that the world is against them. How it's relevant, super relevant to us is that the study went one step further and did one further experiment, which was she asked the volunteers who were in the out-of-control group to stop what they were doing and tell a story about which they felt a sense of pride or ownership. She asked them to talk about something they were passionate about. And in 60 seconds of telling a story, when she showed them the images again, they saw nothing. So my question to you is, how can we design interfaces and design community settings that make people feel in control, that take people in that out-of-control group and center them with a personal story or with something they feel ownership on? And would our communities become more wise as a result? Try it. Let's find out. So this is me. I have some links to those studies on powazic.com. I'll be here for the rest of the conference. Please come say hi. Thank you again for your attention.